For 60 years, Phil Coulter from Derry has been immersed not only in piano music, but almost every aspect of the music business. His fame is worldwide, and this year he released yet another CD, Echoes of Home. As he describes it, going back to the basics. I'm Deirdre Saravia, and we discussed his work over the years. You've had a wonderful life, certainly entertainment-wise, and I remember all those CDs coming out. What was the very first one? Was it Classic Tranquility? I mean, the Irish
ones? Well, remember, that's exactly right. That's exactly right, Classic Tranquility, which I have to tell you, I recorded that as a promise I'd made myself for years that I would one day get around to doing an album of kind of tunes that I'd loved growing up, and I would just wanted to do them with the piano, with the strings, and I suppose really what I wanted to do, Derry, was treat them with a little bit of dignity and a little bit of style, you know. But I was completely unprepared for the fact that Classic Tranquility just went through the roof, and to be honest, it kind of propelled me into another direction in my career.
In which direction?
Well, I was quite happily making my living as a songwriter, record producer, arranger, whatever. It wasn't like for the first 20 years in the music business, I was quite happily pursuing all of those areas, but there was never any burning ambition deep in my heart to become a performer. It wasn't as if, you know, when I'd be conducting for Richard Harris, or where I'd be standing backstage for any of the other acts that I was producing, be it the Bay City Rollers or anywhere else, I never had this burning kind of a desire to be on there, you know. I think there are such a things like born performers, you know, like the Liza Minnellis of this world, who just have to be on stage doing their business. And then there are kind of accidental performers like myself. It was only after the success of not only Classic Tranquility, but the follow-up Sea of Tranquility, which outsold Classic Tranquility and persuaded me that I'd kind of stumbled upon something that did have great potential and had a life outside of Ireland.
Well, you know, indeed, there were sort of groundbreakers in the Irish scene, I suppose. I mean, I'm thinking of the Dubliners and the Chieftains and, you know, even the Clancy brothers as well. And then you come along and again, you're bringing another sort of side to this whole Irish thing.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to see that I had worked as a producer, alongside of some of my friends that I'm used to think that I was quite schizophrenic, because I would spend like the month of January in the studio with the Bay City Rollers recording like teeny bopper songs and hits like Saturday Night. Then the following month I'd be in the studio with the Dubliners recording a completely different style of music, and then I'd be back in the studio doing more pop stuff with some of my old Slick or Kenny or one of those bands, or writing for Elvis Presley. Then the month after that, I'd be back in the studio with Planxty, you know, the one of the groundbreaking Irish bands, or with the Fury Brothers or Paddy Riley or Liam Clancy. So I had the opportunity to work within that area of Irish folk music with some of the best interpreters of the whole thing. So the idea of bringing an orchestral texture to it all was something, I suppose, that grew out of my experience in that idiom, and indeed my love for Irish music as well. But it was, I have to tell you, not a grand strategic career move that had been planned for years and years. It was a glorious and happy accident.
What did you study at Queen's University?
I studied music and Celtic studies. So I came out, I've been able to play the piano and talk in Irish fluently. So that was a pretty good deal.
Well, I guess it was also a great preparation for your future career.
Well, you know, it is. And to this day, when after concert, there'll be there's a kind of a standard group who would come back to visit me. There'd be a family unit. There'd be a mother and father, along with the granny and the granddad, and there'd be kids who are studying music or studying the piano. And I always make the point that music is something which enriches your life. I can't say the same for studying algebra or geometry or trigonometry or whatever, but I can't say that studying music is something which enriches your life. And I always encourage kids to to stick with their music. I say it's given to very few to make a career from music.
Mm-hmm.
But every hour that you invest in music, learning an instrument, will be repaid, because music is a great companion apart from anything else. But if you are going to pursue it as a career, there is no substitute for having learned the craft, learned the theory, so that you can talk with some authority when you're talking to an orchestra, or when you're doing an orchestration, or where you're playing piano, whatever it might be, so that you're not at any stage likely to get caught out, because you're actually not bluffing, but you really know what you're talking about.
Well, tell me then, are you good at mathematics?
That's a very easy a question to answer, and the answer is no.
No,
I always struggled at math.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are quite a few musicians who apparently seem to have an ability to do math, but
absolutely. I mean, my one of my tutors at Queen's, and the one with whom I had the closest relationship in terms of a passion for music, had been a lecturer in maths, and he jumped ship. He'd been kind of an amateur musician. He jumped ship from maths and went back and studied music and became a very accomplished musician, composer, etc. Called Raymond Warren. So I have encountered that phenomenon of mathematicians who are also musicians. I ain't one of them.
Okay. Well, you've been very successful, nevertheless. So
yeah, I can count how many cents are in a dollar. That's for sure.
I bet, and those dollars can certainly mount up. So, listen, you are living in Ireland now. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I've lived here in County Wicklow for the last 20 years. We moved back. I was a bit of a journeyman, songwriter, and a musician, etc. I lived. When I left university, I went straight to London, lived there for 20-something years. In between times, I lived in California for a couple of years, lived in Beverly Hills, right in the middle of the madness. I lived in France for a while, so I kind of journeyed around the place. But Geraldine, my wife, and I have 6 kids, and the youngest was just a matter of a couple of months old when we decided that we wanted to bring our kids up in Ireland, so we moved back about 20 years ago to County Wicklow here.
Let's talk about this Echoes of Home. You play the piano, obviously, yes. You've played the piano all your life?
Well, you know, I was brought up in a musical household. I had 2 brothers and 2 sisters. I was the second youngest. So my 2 elder brothers and my elder sister, we would all have been sent to piano lessons. I would like to be able to tell you that I was a natural and just embraced it from day one. Quite the contrary. I hated it. I hated the piano. I hated having to practice. I hated scales. I hated arpeggios. But most of all, I hated my piano teacher.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because he was an old school teacher who used to kind of crack you over the fingers with a ruler, you know, if you played a few wrong notes. So I certainly didn't prosper. And luckily my father had the good sense to see that I was getting nowhere. So as he said himself, look, we can barely afford these piano lessons, so if it's going nowhere, let's just forget the whole thing. And inside I went, yes!
Mm-hmm. Not what I wanted.
Practicing. But then when I was 11 or 12, when I went to St. Columb's in Derry, I in the meantime had learned to play the piano by ear, to pick up pop songs by ear. And it was then... curiosity and a desire to learn more about it that made me go back to studying the piano. I could pick out tunes in my right hand and play the melody no problem, but I wondered, like, what does the left hand do? How does this all work? So I was curious as to how it all came together, and that, I tell you what, Deirdre, that was a great motivation to learn at the age of 11 or 12. That the best motivation for doing anything is when you want to do it.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about that, and it doesn't become a chore anymore. It becomes a joy.
No, and it hasn't been. The piano has been part of my life ever since. I mean, the piano, I can't conceive of life without a piano.
You've collaborated with a lot of actually singers as well on this Echoes of Home, but nobody sings. There are no vocals at all, are there?
No, that's a different. I mean, that's what makes this different. I mean, it's different on a few areas. Number one, whether I was being brave or foolhardy, I'm still not sure. But I decided that this was an album I wanted to do. Completely solo, stand the orchestra down and just get right back to the basics with the sound of the piano. Now this really is right back to the essentials. It's just the piano, no orchestra, therefore the critical thing in that scenario is the melodies that you pick have got to stand up. because there's no distractions with big sweeping string textures or woodwind or horns or whatever. The melody has to stand up with just the piano as a backup. So that informed my choice of the tracks. All of these melodies, whether they be from Scotland, from Ireland, from Wales, or from Nova Scotia, they're all stunningly beautiful melodies. Some of them are hundreds of years old. Others are comparatively new, but they've all got just great, strong melodies which stand up on the piano. The only help that I called for, without the orchestra, the only help that I enlisted were from five of my musician friends. For example, Moya Brennan of Clannad, and as you say, it's an unusual discovery for people to find out that Moya is not singing on this album, rather she's playing harp because she's an accomplished harpist. Equally, Paul Brady, great singer-songwriter, he's not singing either or playing guitar, he's playing tin whistle. So there's a few unexpected twists there. So all in all, I mean, it's a bit fresh and it's a bit different. And when you've made as many albums as I have, Deirdre, when you've been in the business, next year I'll be celebrating 50 years in the music business. Looking for something that is fresh, looking for something that is still stimulating, and something which is challenging, is always the task. That's always something which should get you should get you wound up for the job and get you enthused again about what you're doing. I would never want to be turning out albums just by rote. I'd never want to be doing it on automatic pilot. I always want to be excited before I go into the studio.
So how do you imagine people listening to this? I mean, in their home, in their car, how?
All of the above. I mean, my music has found its way into all kinds of places, be it in the deck of a car, of a commuter's car, driving backwards and forwards to work through heavy traffic. A number of emails I have had from people who say that my music has saved their lives and their sanity while they're sitting in traffic. Mm-hmm. It's found its way into a lot of people's dens at home when they come back after a day's work, pour a glass of wine and sit down, have a bite to eat, and put on one of my albums to kind of chill to. Mm-hmm. They've even found their way into operating theaters and in hospitals, into various kinds of therapies. I mean, my music is not party music, you know. I mean, what it is, my music celebrates the power of melody, and that's really people who have got that appreciation of a great tune. They don't necessarily need to be Celtic or of Celtic extraction, but because they just need to be able to recognize the power of a great melody.
It might be a great inspiration for piano teachers to play it for their students who don't want to learn the piano.
Well, you know, if that happens, then so much the better. So much the better. What I wanted to revisit was, I have a love affair with the piano that's like probably 60-something years old at this stage. And still there is a magic. When you sit down I would never ever take for granted the luxury of sitting down at a 9-foot Steinway concert grand on stage and playing it, or indeed in a recording studio, especially in a recording studio where in an album like this you can investigate all of the subtleties of the textures on a piano, so that you can, if you explore that bottom end, you can make it sound like a full orchestra. You can whisper up at the top end. You can make it. You can go through a whole range of emotions and textures and dynamics, and that's exciting. And for an old war horse like myself, it's still it's still something that gives me a charge.
Are you going to be touring with this album?
We're coming to the States. I haven't toured in the States now for 3 or 4 years, but we're in Carnegie Hall in early December. I think it's the 8th of December, and we're at some other venues on the East Coast right then. So hopefully we can add more to that tour. Nothing would please me more to get right across the States. My last coast to coast travels through America would have been when I was musical director and musical ringmaster for a show that I was a co-creator on called Celtic Thunder.
Oh, I'm well aware of Celtic Thunder. Yeah, I interviewed Keith Harkin.
Well, I um, I was the kind of musical guru for all of that in its original stage, mm-hmm. when it was evolving as a stage. I did all of the early auditions and wrote all the early songs, etc. Before the relationship fractured, I'm sorry to say, but that was very exciting right then because it was new and it was different, and all of the singers that I had auditioned and signed on were all fresh and all completely new to the game. So it was something exciting to watch it, to watch that burgeoning of talent. I went to the road having, I've chosen all of the musicians in the orchestra as well. I would tour for the first 2 or 3 weeks to make sure that everything was sitting nicely, and maybe I would drop in unexpectedly occasionally just to make sure that the standard was still being observed. But that was the last time that I did any extensive touring in the States.
Didn't George Donaldson, didn't he die?
Sadly so, yeah. Sadly so, last month at 46 years of age, had a massive heart attack, and the poor man was dead before the ambulance arrived. I was particularly sad because George, his story, he was in many ways, I thought he had the best story in Celtic Thunder, because he used to enjoy telling me that the only reason that he turned up for auditions for Celtic Thunder in Glasgow, because he'd been singing Phil Coulter songs for years around the pubs in Glasgow, and he was curious. He thought he had no chance of getting the audition, but he was curious just to see what this guy Phil Coulter looked like. So in the event, he failed that audition because he was just so nervy, fluffed his lines and missed out. He had been working for 20 years in a bus at a bus building factory, been building buses for all of his adult life, and just singing around pubs on weekends. There was something engaging about his enthusiasm. He had a lovely kind of a sense of humor, a nice smile, and a nice presence about him. So that when he failed that audition, we went back to Dublin. There was still that slot that we hadn't filled for a more kind of a mature performer. And I just kept coming back to this big bald-headed guy from Glasgow. So I decided, let's get him back. So I got him back, and he wasn't much better, it has to be said, of the second edition. But there was just something engaging about his whole persona. And I thought, whatever mistakes he's making right now, I can eradicate those, because that's what I do. You know, I'm a record producer. I'm a musical director. I can help him through this barrier that he has. So I'm very glad that I made that decision, because for George, more than anybody else, he thought he had won the lotto. This was his dream job, you know. This is a guy who had seen life from the other side. I mean, he knew what the others were complaining about, the hard work and rehearsals, etc. George used to laugh and tell them he knew nothing about hard work.
Yeah.
He said hard work is when you're standing in a bus queue at 7 a.m. in the rain every morning to go in and do an 8-hour day. That's hard work.
He won't ask for your pity or your sympathy, but surely you must care. Scorn not his simplicity, but rather try to love him all the more. Scorn not his simplicity, oh no.
So, listen, you've collaborated with so many people over the years. I mean, when you were a boy in Derry, did you ever see yourself having this life ahead of you? No, obviously you didn't, actually, did you?
No, when I was practicing my upright piano in a little terraced house in Derry, I had no idea that that was going to be my career. I knew that I loved it more than anything else, but it's a big, big step from having a passion for music and being able even to make a career out of it, to make a living out of it, let alone to do it on a kind of a level that I've been fortunate enough to do it, and to work with people who were then my heroes. For example, I mean, when I was in my teens listening to pop music and becoming besotted by pop music, I remember vividly when Elvis Presley arrived on the scene and changed the face of pop music.
Mm-hmm.
Pop music, I can remember songs like "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window,"
mm-hmm.
or "She Wears Red Feathers and a Hooly Hooly Skirt." I mean, you know, pop music was kind of cute. It certainly wasn't sexy until Presley came along with "Hound Dog" and "Don't Be Cruel" and "Heartbreak Hotel," etc., and the whole game changed.
Mm.
So, what I'm a student at St. Columb's College in Derry, and I'm listening to Hound Dog, and I'm trying to learn it on the piano and learn the words and singing it to myself in my bedroom mirror. I never would have dreamed that years later Elvis Presley would sing one of my songs. I never would have dreamed that I would become the only non-American songwriter to write a top five single for Elvis Presley.
Did you ever meet him?
I would love to tell you, Deirdre, that we hung out together drinking Jim Beam whiskey, shooting the breeze and singing Negro spirituals on the piano.
At Graceland?
The best I can tell you is I was backstage after one of his concerts and he grunted in my direction when he was introduced to me. So at least he acknowledged the space that I was occupying for all those 5 seconds.
Well, he was called the king, you know, not for nothing.
Absolutely. No, he was. I mean, he was the game changer, you know, but without a shadow of a doubt, without a shadow of a doubt. So, no, it's one of my prouder boasts as a songwriter to have written for Presley.
I know it's hard to understand. Why did we ever start? We're more like strangers now, each acting out of part. I have laughed, I have cried. I've lost every game, taking all I can take, but I'll stay here just the same. Because you're all I have, my boy. You are my life, my pride, my joy. And if I stay, I stay because
now, you also have collaborated a couple of times, I noticed, with James Galway. Actually, he's now Sir James. No, sir, mm-hmm. No sirs, no knighthoods in your future?
No, I come from the other side of the tracks.
Yeah. What about Jerry Fitt?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, everybody has got to make their own call. You know, everybody's got to make their own call on that. I was offered one of those official
awards,
kind of a recognition. but I decided that it wasn't, I wouldn't have been comfortable with it because while I had a very successful time and a very enjoyable time in when I lived in London, and London was very good to me, I learned a lot about my craft in London, but I'm Irish.
Yeah,
you know, I'm Irish.
I know.
I'm 100% Irish. I'm 100%, of course, I'm Northern Irish, and I'm immensely proud of that. But that's it, you know. I mean, I wouldn't have felt comfortable, and I don't need, my ego's in good enough shape without accepting like an MBE or an OBE or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, Phil Coulter's good enough. That's a name that's recognised around the world and respected highly.
Well, you know, there are other people from my background who've been comfortable accepting those that kind of recognition, and I have no problem with that. You know, I mean, that's,
sure,
everyone has got to make their own call.
Sure.
But I'd sooner try and impress the postman by other ways.
Did you ever collaborate with Neil Hannon, the Divine Comedy?
I never collaborated with him, but we have shared the bill on a couple of occasions. Most recently, when Derry was nominated the UK City of Culture, which was a wonderful year in my hometown. And the inaugural concert was a grand affair in Derry with all kinds of people who had links with Derry, including Neil Hannon, including Snow Patrol, including the Undertones, Dana, the singing priests, all kinds of people. It was a wonderful, wonderful celebration of music in Derry. And Neil Hannon, of course, was one of those. He's really quirky, very talented guy, and totally off the wall.
Oh, I love his lyrics. I really do.
Yes.
I think they're just hilarious, and they're just dead on. They really are.
Yeah, they're very tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, absolutely. Of course they are. The other thing I read about you, and I didn't realise this, I mean, it was never apparent to me, the white suit. You wear a white suit?
No, I don't know where the white suit stories come from. I mean, I have in the past worn a white suit when
Oh, you have a white suit on the cover of this album, though, Echoes of Home.
Am I wearing? Oh no, that's a dinner jacket.
Sorry, it's a white dinner jacket.
It's a dinner jacket.
I was just going to ask you, do you have some predilection for the color white? That's all.
No, I mean I have a bunch of dinner jackets. That's one of them that happens to be white. And I at some stage or other, I would have had a white linen suit that I would have worn in tropical climes or on a cruise ship or something. But I mean, I don't have an obsession either with the color white or with white suits.
No. I just read somewhere that you liked wearing white suits, and I thought, oh, that's kind of.
No, I think somebody's oversimplifying my sartorial choices.
And listen, the photograph on the front of Echoes of Home, where's that from? It's just gorgeous.
That's Donegal. That's me walking my dogs up in Donegal.
No, really? That's yeah. You? Oh, mm-hmm. That is fantastic. And what part of Donegal?
Just the back of my Moor Gap.
Ah, really? I used to spend my summers up in Gweedore and Ranafast and...
Ranafast, just so did I.
That's
myself.
Right.
I spent a couple of great summers up there learning my... practicing my Irish and a few other, learned a few other skills as well.
Oh, I know well what you learned. Mm-hmm. We were all there. Have you had good sales on this album?
Well, it's just out. I mean, it just was released last week, and when last I checked, in its first week, it had gone into number 16 in the Amazon Celtic Music or World Music charts. So that's off to a good start. I mean, you know, my albums are they all take their time. People discover them and buy them. My albums are not the kind of albums that rocket to number one in the charts. You
no.
know, I mean, that's not really what my believers are not that excitable. You know, I mean, they will discover that the album is out and hopefully. They'll hear the word on the jungle drums that it's a good album, that it's full of great tunes, and that it's different, because not only am I reinvestigating just that glorious sound of the piano, but that I've got some interesting collaborators on there as well. So you know, there's a number of different reasons for investigating my album.
And did you pick the sequencing for these songs, like starting out with the Flower of Macharali?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's part and parcel of the job. I mean, when you're a jack of all trades as I am, and when you've been doing this as long as I have, every detail, I sign off on every detail. I sign off on everything from the recording studio, what studio, to the recording engineer, to the musicians, to the collaborators, to the choice of material. To the choice of the running order, to the choice of the artwork, everything. I sign off on everything. I don't leave anything to choice and nothing to chance. I believe that the attention to detail, it's the little things. The difference between being average and being very good, or the difference between being very good and being great, is not one big step. It's a whole lot of little steps. And so I think it's my responsibility to take those little steps as well.
Do you lecture, actually, aspiring musicians?
No, it's a question I've been asked often. I was for a number of years, I was a visiting professor in Boston College in their Irish Studies program, and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed that. I enjoy just engaging with a younger generation of bright and talented people. But I used to confuse them. By my opening conversation with him at the start of each semester that I had a new intake was, you're obviously very bright, but you're obviously very talented. But I just want to clarify one thing with you. Do you appreciate what your talent entitles you to? And they would look at me vacantly, and I would say, well, I tell you, your talent entitles you to absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you do something with your talent.
Mm-hmm.
Your talent is a gift from God. Don't mm-hmm. congratulate yourself on your talent.
Mm-hmm.
That's to do with the genes of your parents. Congratulate yourself when you grasp that talent, when you realize that it is a gift, and with the gift comes a responsibility to do something.
Mm-hmm. How inspirational. That's why you should be teaching.
You reckon?
Absolutely, of course, because there are people who can put things in words and others who, well, they just teach their subject. But I think that'd be very, I mean, really, of course, I'm sure at this point you've no desire to stand up in front of a classroom.
Oh, well, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed Boston College, and down through the years I've had other inquiries from other universities to do the same sort of thing. And there are so many colleges now, so many universities that are doing Celtic studies as part of their curriculum. And you know, there's one thing about that. One of the courses that I lectured them on was Irish music the development of Irish music across the board in the last 50 years. And I used to love being able to say to them, right, what I'm going to tell you about Irish music over the last 40, 40, 50 years, is not something that I learned from books. This is something that I lived through.
Phil, it has been really such a pleasure talking to you. It's been wonderful, and I've always been an enormous admirer of all your work in all its different guises.
Thank you so much, dear.
You are a very, very talented man, and you're a great asset to Ireland.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you so much.
Maybe politics could be in your future as well.
I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think my fuse is quite that long.
No.
I think I've got my hands full with doing what I'm doing. You know, look, there's not a day goes by that I don't thank God that for we're close on 50 years, I've made a living from something that I love to do.
Oh, yeah.
I'm grateful for the fact that I still have the energy. I'm particularly grateful for the fact that people still enjoy what I do. People still like to go out and buy my albums and buy tickets to come to my concert. Mm-hmm. That's the bit over which I have no control. But I'm delighted that I've been able to keep doing it. I've been able to keep productive and been able to keep my edge and to keep my appetite.
Phil, thank you so much for speaking with me.
My great pleasure.
All right.
My great pleasure. God bless. Bye-bye.
Garamila Mayogat.